Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. This hour, we'll hear about ways scammers try to get your personal and financial information. They're becoming more persistent, and it puts you at risk. We'll talk with an expert about ways to avoid becoming a victim. Wine consumption is on a downward trend. What does that mean for wineries in the Midwest? A popular film festival that bears the name of the late film critic Roger Ebert is apparently coming to an end. We'll hear more. An author set out to document his grandfather's World War II service, but he found much more. A woman held in an Illinois prison had her artwork presented to the Pope. More on that story. The card game Magic the Gathering was actually banned at prisons. Now it's playing a key role for some of those incarcerated. And the game Pokemon Go is still, well, going. And how did corn detasseling become a political issue? Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Scammers will always find new ways to steal consumers' money and personal information, and advancements in technology and artificial intelligence are making those scams easier to pull off every day. As shoppers make their holiday purchases, scammers are hard at work. Sasha Ann Simons talked with Steve Burness, who's president of the Better Business Bureau of Chicago in Northern Illinois, about how consumers can protect themselves from falling prey to fraud.
Why is the holiday season prime for scams?
Well, obviously, scammers go where the money's at. So they know consumers spend a lot of money on holiday gifts, looking online. So the scammers always tend to go where the money's at. That's where they go every year. And this is a perennial problem for us. And I've been doing this for 38 years, and there's always a spike around the holiday season, and everybody has shifted mostly to online doing some of their shopping.
How much do holiday hustles cost consumers and businesses every year? Walk us through that.
It's difficult to say because most consumers don't complain or see when they have an issue. So, you know, some statistics show that 9 out of 10 consumers don't report a loss. But overall, you know, throughout the year, the Federal Trade Commission, you know, basically says billions of dollars is lost to fraud. Like I mentioned, there's always a surge in the holiday shopping season, especially towards the tail end of the year, including charity fraud, because, you know, most consumers, you know, who do want to give will give to a charity, but they want to get that tax deduction in for short end of the year. So the scammer knows that and creates fake charities as well. So there's always somebody out there, Sasha, who wants to take your money. And unfortunately, it's in the billions of dollars each and every year.
Jeez, that's so tough to hear, but it's so true, right? Who is doing this scamming?
They're coming from all over. It's really hard, you know, with the technology today. They can be anywhere in the world and make it look like they're calling locally. I mean, caller ID still can be manipulated. There's millions of emails that are sent, it seems like, every day by the scammers. So they're all over the place. I mean, you really can't tell what they look like, what they sound like, and it's just that they're everywhere, and it's really hard to determine, you know, where they're exactly coming from because of the technology. But a lot of it has shifted online, like I mentioned, because of the pandemic. And number one scam, the Better Business Bureau all across North America, is online fraud. And it just keeps growing and growing. And tying that a little bit into identity theft, it's not a matter of if, Sasha, it's a matter of when you'll become a victim of identity theft. It's just happening so rampant right now, but they always tie it into the holiday season because sometimes they just want your information, your credit card information, that's all. And sometimes they want your personal information, though. Like you're saying, your license is expired, you'll get a text. You know, your license expired, fill it in here. What's your Social Security number?
Yeah. I've been getting so many texts lately, too. Just I can spot them because I've talked to you and folks like you enough to spot the warning signs. But I do worry about people who can fall for this because the language sometimes seems quite believable.
It is quite believable. And sometimes you use scare tactics as well. And what we're seeing right now at the Better Business Bureau is like, oh, congratulations, you bought the TV. Thank you so much. If you didn't buy it, click here. So they put you in that panic mode that something's wrong or your account's been charged. So you click that link and it's a scammer saying, okay, we charged you for your TV, but we need your credit card number. We'll give your money back. What's your credit card number? What's your 3-digit code on the back? So again, the texts are coming and the reason they work is because people are continuing to click on them. We hear from consumers each and every day at the Better Business Bureau, not only here locally, but all across the nation
right.
and North America. for consumers who fall for it. The only way to put scams out of business is not to give them your business. That's the only way. I mean, there's not enough government, there's not enough police out there, there's not enough law enforcement to go after all these criminals. So you got to be more proactive instead of reactive.
Right. You know, and even thinking more along the lines of the timing, Steve, and why holidays are such prime times for this type of activity. I was just kind of perusing over the weekend on Nextdoor, which is that app, you know, with you know, all the folks who live near you. And I did see some chatter. I feel like people are starting to look out for it. You know, someone on the app was talking about how, you know, poverty breeds crime is what she said. And, you know, lots of folks were in the comments and deciding whether or not they agreed with that overall statement. But more so the sentiment was about how this time of, you know, seeing what's happened with the government shutdown, putting a pause on SNAP benefits for people. And just, you know, we just talked jobs on the program and, you know, how we're hearing about folks being unemployed. How sort of desperate times are calling for desperate measures and people are turning to things like these scams. Does that sound accurate at all to you?
It does. It does. And I've been doing this for 38 years. Yes, desperate times go, you know, desperate measures from different people. But the scammer doesn't care. They go after where the money's at. So, for instance, they'll go after a doctor or a lawyer. It doesn't matter to them. But unfortunately, there are more scams out there because of the tough times, but also because everybody has shifted towards the online world. So we're seeing a combination of multiple channels of, you know, where these scammers are coming from, but also, you know, what they're after, just increasing overall. And again, most times when they send text out, they don't know who they're sending it to. They don't know if they're sending it to a judge, a doctor, lawyer, a policeman, or,
right,
or whoever. They're just throwing everything at the wall and sees who sticks. And I think consumers are too gullible still.
Mm. And so they, it sounds a little bit random, everything. But it also sounds like they're getting smarter, these swindlers.
They are getting smarter. Yes, they are getting smarter, the scammers, unfortunately, and we're seeing that in the job market. So since you apply for jobs online, your resume is everywhere. Well, the scammer knows that, and they say you offer you a job, and then they take you through three or four different interviews only to tell you we need your Social Security number and your mother's maiden name, your bank account number to deposit your check. Well, did these people believe that they'd just been interviewed by a legitimate organization because they went through three or four interviews? And the scammers are doing that now.
Wow.
You know, so
that is clever. I might fall for something like
day.
That.
A lot of people fall for it. I received a recent call from a reporter, you know, whose husband fell for it. You know, it's so believable.
Wow.
Because you apply for jobs online, your resume's everywhere, your email's everywhere. So they're getting so sophisticated with scams now. So they're targeting anybody. Again, they target people, you know, they can go after people that, you know, are behind in their payments. They have this information, or people that already fallen for a scam that you go on a sucker list. And that's why we advise consumers never to fill out those survey requests to win money or win prizes.
Absolutely.
Because you never know what a company's doing with that information. They can tell you're not doing anything with it, but we don't know where it's going, and it's just increasing right now.
So leave us with this. Top three pieces of advice that you want to give shoppers as they listen to us. How can we protect ourselves, Steve?
The most important thing is obviously check out the company or offer before clicking on that link. So if you get this pop-up ad that appears on the side of your computer, there's no way I would click on that link unless I know who's behind that ad. And unfortunately, you can't tell sometimes. So that's the most important thing. Check out, you know, the charity itself before donating to the charity. Make sure that they are a legitimate organization. That's not a telemarketer just calling you out of the blue. And also on when you're shopping online, be careful of counterfeit websites. That's the number one complaint to the Better Business Bureau. Even the major companies have counterfeit sites attributed to them. And so what I'm saying is that they put on their website, there's counterfeit sites like ours.
Mm-hmm.
Don't fall for it. I mean, I think consumers in a fast-paced society are too fast into determining buying things without doing the research on the company to make sure that URL is the proper URL, not an additional character in there. So it's best not to click links. And if anybody tells you got to do something in 30 minutes, that's the tip off to the rip off.
Oh yeah.
You don't have to do something in 30 minutes. Check them out first. The only thing you do in 30 minutes, Sasha, is buy a pizza and that's it.
Right. And just in case we do suspect that we've been scammed, what recourse do consumers have?
Yes, please come to the Better Business Bureau, not only to help you with your complaint, but if you see a scam, report it to us first, because somebody will fall for it. You may not, but somebody will. We have Scam Tracker. Everything's on the Better Business Bureau website at bbb.org. And you can also find businesses that you can trust. We're a referral agency. Most consumers don't realize that as well.
Steve Burness is president and CEO of the Better Business Bureau of Chicago and Northern Illinois. Thank you so much. Great tips.
Thank you so much.
Governor J.B. Pritzker and his wife M.K. recently visited Pope Leo in Rome. They presented the Illinois-born Pope with a few gifts, including a drawing done by a woman incarcerated at a state prison. Mawu Iqbal spoke to the artist about her piece and how art has impacted her life behind bars.
It was a 40-minute long meeting with the Pope, where Illinois' first couple discussed immigration, extended an invite to Chicago, and gave the Pope, quote, good tidings from Illinois. Here's M.K. Pritzker gifting one of those tidings, a framed drawing. The First Lady's description of it to the Pope was filmed by Catholic broadcaster EWTN News.
Done by an immigrant who was incarcerated in Illinois. And the black and white is how she was before she became incarcerated.
She is 38-year-old Yesenia Diaz, and she's currently incarcerated at the Logan Correctional Center, about 175 miles south of Chicago near Springfield.
I was like, are you serious? Like the Pope, like in Rome? At first, I was, I didn't know why the First Lady would be interested in giving my drawing to the Pope, because my drawing is not that great.
Diaz says drawing is not her strong suit. She's more fluent in making crafts using paper and paints and whatever else she can find around the prison's garden. But when the First Lady invited those incarcerated in Illinois prisons to submit drawings for an art contest, Diaz couldn't pass it up.
It was just an honor that we got privileged to do these things, to do something positive and to be part of the community outside, even from the inside.
Diaz, who's originally from Chicago's Pilsen neighborhood, submitted a drawing of herself as a young girl, dancing in a garden with a bouquet of flowers in one hand and a monarch butterfly resting on the other. Half the drawing is in black and white, depicting a barbed wire fence and a prison tower. The other half is in color, showing sunshine, flowering bushes, and a white picket fence.
Because before, even though I was alive, my spirit was kind of, my heart, my mind was kind of like dead. So by God's healing, I got to see how beautiful life it can be.
The contest was dubbed Art is Healing, and the top four winners' artwork were featured at M.K. Pritzker's tent at the Illinois State Fair this past summer. In a statement, the First Lady says she chose Diaz's drawing because it's a, quote, beautiful example of Illinois' efforts to treat all humans with dignity and respect. Diaz is currently serving a 33-year sentence for murder. She's been in prison since she was 20 years old. And she says making art, tending to the garden, decorating the unit for the holidays, has all helped pass the time.
It might be something simple, but it always brings smiles to other people. So that's kind of my reward, like just to see people smile. And I feel like by seeing other ones being blessed by my gift, I get blessed too.
Diaz, a devout Christian, didn't get to see the Pope's reaction. But the Pope seemed to understand the meaning she was trying to convey when M.K. Pritzker showed him her work. The Pope took one look at Diaz's work and then said, finding God.
Mawu Iqbal with that report. The process of removing the tops of corn plants to control pollination, or detasseling, has become a political issue in Nebraska. For years, contractors hiring local teens have claimed that big seed companies are prioritizing workers with H-2A visas for the job. A new law was supposed to reveal who's doing the work, but it sparked more questions. With Molly Ashford of Harvest Public Media, Nick Loomis reports for the Midwest Newsroom.
For 9 years, Scott Wilcox hired detasseling crews in Nebraska. He says young Nebraskans can do 100% of the summer job, often seen as a rite of passage. When biotech giant Bayer discontinued his contract in 2020, Wilcox suspected migrant workers with H-2A visas were hired instead.
I mean, you know, they don't have to take care of them like they are required to take care of us, the kids from Nebraska. So it was just a way cheaper way for them to go.
Employers must prove that no domestic labor is available to hire H-2A workers. Bayer said in a statement that it employs more local youth in Nebraska than any of its other U.S. production sites. Legislative aide Joel Hunt authored a bill that aimed to identify who performs the labor in seed cornfields and ensure local workers are prioritized. Hunt says it got watered down with amendments before it became state law in 2024. One of the changes shielded many hiring specifics from the public record.
So the Department of Agriculture has all of the numbers. What they're posting on the website is just what's required in statute.
He added that penalties for non-reporting were also removed.
There's almost no way to actually enforce this bill.
The Nebraska Department of Agriculture published the first annual report on September 30th.
What do we got? Four columns and two rows.
Brent Ailes is the co-owner of Ailes Detasseling in Lincoln, Nebraska.
And it's a very, very, what I might call a 30,000-foot view of not much detail.
The report shows that in 2025, mostly teenage crews performed 60% of detasseling. It's unclear what part of the remaining 40% was performed by H-2A crews because there are no details about the number of workers hired, who hired them, or where they came from. That missing information was the original intention of the law. Nebraska Department of Labor Commissioner Katie Thurber confirms that seed companies have gravitated toward H-2A labor in the past decade.
I think it's broadly popular because it's a known commodity as to what you're going to get. And I think it's really marketed to the agricultural industry so they know about its availability.
But local contractors say that young Nebraskans are available and point to wait lists as proof that they're being ignored.
I think it means there's probably a disconnect, not necessarily that the law isn't being followed.
Iowa farmer Mark Aaron says he always found plenty of teenagers from Cedar Falls to detassel. His contract was discontinued by corn behemoth Corteva Agriscience last year. With grain prices currently down, he wishes he still had that contract.
But probably the only money I would have made this year.
Aaron's estimates that 20% of detasseling is done by teenagers in Iowa, where there is no law to track the labor. Across the border, Brent Ailes says he's happy Nebraska lawmakers want to keep the job in local hands, even though the recent report hasn't been illuminating.
So I'm thankful that there is still a strong opportunity across the state for many, many kids to participate in detasseling if they choose to.
Ailes says some teenagers may prefer a service industry job to working in a cornfield in late July, but he says he still had a wait list. He hopes he'll have more acres so they can continue the tradition next year. With Harvest Public Media's Molly Ashford, I'm Nick Loomis with the Midwest Newsroom.
More ahead on Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. For more than two decades, Ebertfest entertained filmgoers in Champaign-Urbana and beyond as the largest film festival in the region. This fall, festival organizers announced they won't be coming back, although there is some discussion of a possible encore. Aoishi Basu reports.
Ebertfest was unlike any other event in Champaign-Urbana. The red carpet affair brought world-renowned filmmakers, directors, actors, and musicians to East Central Illinois every spring for a weekend of live music and film at the Virginia Theater, and this happened pretty much every year for 26 years. It was always extravagant, says Andrew Stengley, who worked at Ebertfest for more than a decade.
When you get to see classics, sometimes from film, silent movies with live music accompaniment, and then have guests that were maybe involved with the movies coming up too. It's not something that happens every day.
The late Roger Ebert was one of the most famous movie critics of his time. In the late 90s, Ebert was invited to Champaign to host an event that included a screening of 2001: Space Odyssey. That's where he met film producer Nate Cohn, who had just finished his PhD at the University of Illinois. In a 2024 interview with IPM News, Cohn says, at the time, the Virginia Theater had been closed for many years.
So we reopened the theater, discovered that there was still 70mm projection in the theater, and showed the film to a large audience and was very successful.
They began to talk about hosting an annual festival. Then, in 1999, Roger and Chaz Ebert founded Ebertfest with Cohn as the first director. He says they tried to spotlight films that might otherwise be overlooked.
Chaz and I select the films based on films that we think are important in the particular moment, films we think that deserve a second look, and films that just generally deal with the themes of empathy, which Chaz and Roger were very cognizant of.
Over the years,
Ebert Fest has hosted big names both on screen and in person, like Tilda Swinton, Spike Lee, and Francis Ford Coppola. But the festival also gave a platform to niche films that spoke to the Eberts, says Nat Dykman, director of Champana Film Society.
Ebert Fest is known more for, some people call it IndieWood, that would be, you know, the low-budget Hollywood movies, Sundance hits.
When Ebert Fest announced in September that it wouldn't be back next year, it caught some people by surprise, but not Andrew Stengley.
In general, since Roger passed away, attendance has gone down a bit. And you almost got the feeling that this was coming for a few years now anyway. The previous year, 2024, Chaz Ebert was very wishy-washy on whether they would do another one.
Last month, Chaz Ebert sent an email to Virginia Theater patrons saying an encore may be in order. She declined an interview for this story and didn't respond to questions about when a final decision will be made. Dykman says if Ebert Fest doesn't come back in the spring, he's going to hold his independent film festival, the Savoy Lumiere, around the time Ebert Fest would have been.
I'm hoping to double in size. I'm hoping to have two rooms next year, one of them solely dedicated for documentaries and one of them solely dedicated for narratives. We're hoping to add also an educational component, some lectures or workshops about filmmaking.
And in the meantime, he's hosting screenings at the Savoy 16, called Savoy Art House. At a recent event, the aroma of movie theater popcorn fills the lobby where Dykman is seated at a fold-out table. He passes out postcards advertising upcoming screenings and strikes up conversation with people who stop by.
And I think that any film scene should have sort of a well-rounded options. The idea that I'm able to pull a different film every week and do a screening is what's really been enticing to me.
He says he's always been drawn to the original idea behind Ebert Fest, highlighting overlooked films and creating a space where movie lovers can gather to watch films they can't see anywhere else. I'm Aoishi Basu, IPM News.
The interior's taking shape for the new Goldfarb Center for Performing Arts at Western Illinois University in Macomb. It's even surprising those who go through the building on a regular basis. Rich Egger has more.
Ann Lefter and Ted Renner recently led a tour of the building for a group of people, including local media. Lefter is director of the center. Renner is the deputy director of facilities management at Western. They've taken others through the building, but on this day, they were surprised upon entering the main theater, also known as the Great Hall.
We've been waiting for this for a year.
Renner says it's the first time they had seen the Great Hall with the scaffolding removed. He was impressed.
I'm at a loss for words, honestly. Makes it feel like it's all worthwhile. You know, it's amazing.
And Lefter liked what she saw.
My heart stopped for a second. You can just feel the spaciousness in here, how it just opens up.
Construction of the $119 million building began 3 years ago. Lefter says it should be substantially completed by early March.
These guys are not sitting around. Like, there's work going on every day.
Construction should be fully completed by early June. Lefter says there will be a dedication ceremony when the building is completed, and another major event will be held in the fall to officially open it to the public. The Great Hall will seat 869. Lefter says the acoustics in it will be amazing. The architectural acoustics firm Kierkegaard designed the space so that every element can be adjusted based on what's on stage.
So if it's an orchestra, if it's a rock band, if it's a single speaker, if it's a theater production, there's going to be movable banners back here that allow us to fine-tune. There is a full stage orchestra shell that we can bring out or put away.
Elsewhere around the building, there are several massive window walls. Lefter says there's a reason for that.
Part of the design of this building is that through these window walls, we're sort of inviting the community in to see that art is being made all the time. It's not just when there's a show on the stage. There are performers in here rehearsing. There are students in here learning and honing their crafts. And it's always going on.
She says the building will be in use 12 to 16 hours a day during the times when classes are in session. A smaller black box theater will be able to seat up to 200, depending on how it's configured for a particular performance. It includes a control booth, and there are catwalks where students will hang lights and scene pieces.
This will be a laboratory for our theater students, grad and undergrad students who are studying design and technical direction, as well as the actors. It's a tremendously tricked out space.
The building also includes rehearsal rooms and classrooms for dance, music, and theater. But the scene and costume shops will remain in Brown Hall, which is right next door to the Goldfarb Center.
This building obviously has been through a couple of designs and had to be condensed because of budgetary issues. So every decision was about maximizing student space, maximizing the new space in the new building. So we have a scene shop that works just fine. Don't use any space in this building for another scene shop. Let's give all of that space over to students.
With that in mind, the building has only a few offices for staff. Renner says the Performing Arts Center will help Western attract shows that otherwise might not come to Macomb. Western Hall, which has hosted athletics and other activities for decades, is large enough for shows, but Renner says many times artists decline to perform there because it does not provide everything they need. For example, it does not have rigging capacity for today's scenery requirements.
And that wasn't a slight. It was just that Western Hall didn't have the equipment to be able to support them properly for them to give the performance that they needed. This building will.
Renner says Western Hall was not built to be a performance space. It was built to be a basketball arena. Lefter believes there's a hunger for the arts in the Western Illinois region. She hopes people will come out when they see what's offered at the Goldfarb Center for Performing Arts. Rich Egger reporting.
A Galesburg author set out to document his grandfather's World War II service as a paratrooper. What he uncovered is a web of stories about local people's unique experiences during the war. Jane Carlson has our story.
As a kid growing up in Galesburg, Tom Colglazier would watch Westerns and war movies with his grandfather. That's how we learned that his grandfather had seen some of the heaviest fighting of World War II.
And we were watching the movie The Longest Day when I was a kid. And as the paratroopers descend on the town of St. Mary Glees, he said, I was there. And I said, what? You know, this is real?
From then on, Colglazier was interested in his grandfather's war record. In 1998, Colglazier sat down with him to start recording interviews about his service and his experiences. But that was cut short when his grandfather died just months later. So Colglazier began searching for others who could help him understand his grandfather's service with the 82nd Airborne.
I started contacting other soldiers from his unit. I found some 82nd Airborne troopers here in Galesburg. I met with them, got their stories.
As Colglazier learned their stories, he started hearing other great stories about Galesburg people and World War II.
And I call those people the spokes of the wheel, with Galesburg being the hub.
Those spokes became the heart of Colglazier's book, Spokes of the Wheel. They include Galesburg residents who left to fight and those who later moved there from all over the world. Colglazier interviewed Pearl Harbor survivor Jack McFall and former German soldier Henry Fry, who was captured at Stalingrad, survived a Soviet gulag, and eventually moved to Galesburg. In addition to other soldiers, he talked with a wartime bride, a wartime cadet, and a Knox College professor who had been incarcerated during the war because of his Japanese ancestry.
Mickey Haney, he was a revered professor at Knox, but he was born in Hollister, California, before the federal order came down for Japanese citizens to be interned in camps. So he spent time in an internment camp. His story of how he left the camp, he didn't escape. I mean, he left really under official business, is really interesting. And also the way Mickey told stories was very humorous, so I had a great time talking to Mickey.
Colglazier's grandfather's story and his survival is central to the book. Henry Ray Colglazier was born in Beardstown and came to Galesburg when his father found work on the railroad. Ray was an athlete at Galesburg High School, but lost an entire year of school due to serious illness. Ray recovered, receiving his diploma a year early and qualifying for one of the military's most elite units.
He jumped into Sicily in 1943, as a paratrooper. He participated in the Italian campaign briefly at Salerno, He jumped into Normandy and D-Day. He jumped into Holland during Operation Market Garden. He was trucked into the Ardennes during the Battle of the Bulge and then fought the rest of the way through the Central Europe campaign. And so he really did see the heaviest and hardest fighting of the war.
In 2023, Tom Colclaser followed the same path through Europe with a Dutch historian who helped pinpoint the exact places where his grandfather fought.
Meeting Fritz was a fantastic experience. He showed us, you know, the exact landing spots. He helped us find these intersections where the firefights were.
Colclaser says telling these stories now is vital, not just for history, but for families who may have never heard them. He says his father and aunt were a bit flabbergasted at some of the stories in the book because his grandfather didn't talk much about it to them.
For me, history has always been important because I look at what people have gone through throughout time, any time period, any history, and I wonder how they did it. I wonder what it took, what kind of perseverance, what kind of character makeup it took to actually endure these things.
Colclaser says his grandfather may not have wanted the spotlight like this, but the stories needed to be told.
I think that he would recognize it, and I think that he would be interested in it, but I think that he was very modest. So I don't know that he would want to be the centerpiece of something like this, but I wanted him to be.
Colclaser says the book shows how deeply the war connected Galesburg to the rest of the world. And while the main arcs of the war may be well known, these are the local, personal stories of it. I'm Jane Carlson.
A lot of people have financial questions, and for many, they simply want to know how to pick a personal financial advisor. We asked an expert.
Hello, I'm Sherry Greco-Rikus, co-founder of Rappaport Rikus Capital Management. We manage $1.2 billion in client assets. And also, I am the author of the book, Maximize Your Return on Life, Invest Your Time and Money in Your Values. Probably this is something that you can't pinpoint, but I think the most important thing is the rapport you have with the advisor. So I always advise trying to meet face-to-face. I know a lot of times people are doing things on Zoom, but you can really get a feel for the person face-to-face. You need to feel comfortable with that person. You want to be comfortable to ask questions. You need to understand what they're telling you. You can't be intimidated and fear that they won't answer your questions. You need to understand. But finally, you need to go with your gut. That's probably the most important thing. Then I often tell people, what are you looking for? Are you looking for an advisor that just does investments? Are you looking for someone that just does financial planning and you'll do your own investments? Are you looking for someone that does both? So once you define what you're looking for, it makes the search a little easier. Another great question when you meet with an advisor is you want to know what their approach is to financial planning. You might want to see some examples. Do they have sophisticated tools to do your plans? Can they help you with insurance? Will they coordinate with your estate planning attorney and your taxes? Will they look at your big picture? Will they look at Social Security, college planning? Anything that's on your mind, make sure that they have the skills and the wherewithal to help you with those planning things that you will need. So once you kind of understand their approach to financial planning, a really good question is, how do they get paid? And it should be very transparent. There's several fees that you need to look at. One is the management fee. So that's an overall fee that they may charge. Another is underlying investment fees. So you want to understand the fees within these investment vehicles. Are there trading fees? Are there custody fees? And is financial planning an extra fee? So you want to get all that. And so you can, you know, kind of look at apples to apples when you compare fees. My two last advice that I will give you as we part is I always say interview a few advisors because you'll get a really good indication what you like or don't like and what's most important to you. And at the end of the day, ask for references. You know, obviously they're going to give you happy clients, but you want to just talk to some of the references before you make a final decision. So this is a big decision. I'm a big advocate of hiring a financial advisor. They often will take a lot of the emotion out of the investing and the financial planning, but a good financial advisor will be open. You'll have a good rapport, but you'll be able to exceed your financial goals.
That's Sherry Greco-Rikus, co-founder of Skokie's Rappaport-Rikus Capital Management. The firm manages $1.2 billion in client assets, and Rikus is the author of Maximize Your Return on Life. Invest your time and money in what you value most. We have more of Statewide on the way. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The Illinois Department of Public Health will soon be able to set its own vaccine guidelines independent of the CDC. Governor J.B. Pritzker signed a measure he says is necessary given what he calls misinformation surrounding vaccines coming from the federal government.
The Trump administration has upended the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, the federal body that has long provided states with rigorous, evidence-driven vaccine schedules. So Illinois is stepping up to fill the void.
The measure also requires state-regulated insurance plans to cover vaccinations regardless of federal guidance. And it allows pharmacies to administer flu and COVID-19 vaccines to children as young as 3 without a prescription. It will take effect in January. Nearly a decade has passed since the mobile game Pokemon Go gave people a chance to spend time outside while still playing a video game. Some are still going outside. From Columbia, Missouri, Finnegan Bellow reports.
113 people have RSVP'd to a so-called Pokemon Go Raid Day at Columbia's Cosmo Bethel Park. Even though it's pouring rain, players cram under a pavilion, looking at their phones and waiting to team up. These meetups happen every week or so, and this one is particularly appealing. Players have the chance to acquire a powerful form of one of the game's strongest creatures, Rayquaza. It's a legendary Pokemon that looks like a flying green serpent with gold threads trailing off its body. Players are watching for the top of the hour. That's when raids unlock and they can join forces to battle Rayquaza. If the players win, they get a chance to try and catch it. Then everyone leaves the pavilion and walks around to join more raids scattered around the park. Many of today's players are hoping for a rare, shiny version of Rayquaza. 13-year-old Jensen Mormon has come to the event with his father. He captures the shiny one before leaving the pavilion.
So a shiny is a variation of color from the original Pokemon. For example, Rayquaza, this one is black. And it's very cool. It's kind of, sometimes they're rare, but most of the time, like today, it's a 1 in 10 chance. So it's not as rare, but it's still pretty rare.
We are going to go to the right, okay?
Providing some structure amidst the downpour is Hazer Pishkar. He's a Pokemon Go community ambassador, a volunteer tasked by the game's developer to host meetups and ensure everything goes smoothly.
We start with that one, okay? All right, just pay attention.
When Pokemon Go first came out, Pishkar lived in Guatemala. He immigrated to Missouri about a month later, and he says the game helped him connect with the local community. The meetups started a lot smaller and mostly happened at Stevens Lake Park. Over time, though, the group size grew, events migrated to Cosmo Bethel Park, and Pishkar became one of the group's leaders. He says his favorite part of the work is watching all the players team up and form friendships.
Now seeing more than 50 sometimes, sometimes like 80 people at the park, and you see everybody just talking to each other like there is not any like wall between everybody. Everybody wants to connect.
Kelly Vella is a visiting fellow at the Queensland University of Technology in Australia. She studies games and their effects on social connectedness, and she observed Pokemon Go when the game was its most popular just after release. She says some socially anxious players have used Pokemon Go to work past their struggles talking to others in person. Family members who played the game also grew closer. Vella says some of that may be because of the intergenerational nature of the Pokemon franchise.
I think as well because it was an outdoor gameplay that people who wouldn't typically play video games saw this as a sort of safer bridge or something they could encourage with their children.
Meanwhile, the Columbia Pokemon hunters scatter off in separate groups walking around the park's fishing lake. Pokemon Go's popularity may have peaked in 2016. But on this rainy fall day in Columbia, players still seeking rare Pokemon and connection with fellow gamers hold umbrellas for one another to protect phone screens from the rain. I'm Finnegan Bellow.
Magic the Gathering is a niche card game where players battle each other with spells, wizards, and fantasy creatures. The game was banned at a prison in Danville for years over concerns the valuable cards could pose a safety risk. But Magic is now back at the prison, and among those incarcerated there, the game has developed a loyal following. Emily Hayes has this report.
So this is a commander deck, right? A commander deck is a 100 card
Antonio
deck.
Jones keeps a deck of Magic the Gathering cards in the pocket of his prison uniform. He fans the deck out to show cards with drawings of elven queens, artifacts, and fantastical creatures. As he explains how the cards work, the corrections officer in the room begins to chuckle.
And this, yes, I am. I'm doing this, sir. I'm doing it. It's an awesome game. I recently got into it. I am not ashamed of my nerddom or the fact that I love this game.
Jones is one of a dozen incarcerated men sitting in a classroom in Danville Correctional Center. They are serving out long sentences for charges like sexual assault, murder, or being an accomplice to murder. They have all worked hard to become better versions of themselves, leading peer mentoring classes and working towards bachelor's and master's degrees as much as possible. And all but two play Magic the Gathering. Robert Schultz is another mentor. He teaches about conflict resolution as others in the prison get close to re-entering society. He says Magic is new to him.
There's not that many people who play it, right? Obviously, like, prison culture comes from urban areas, stuff like that, and you don't really find that many people who are playing Magic cards.
Schultz says the game is complex, and they are all really into the rules. They have a lot of time to learn them.
The rules, it depends on who you're playing with, right? It depends. They're very particular. It's like if you ever seen a pickup basketball game in grade school, and everybody thinks they're going to the NBA, so they're calling every single travel, every single like double dribble.
But the game has only recently been allowed at the prison. In 2001, Danville Correctional Center banned family and friends from sending Magic the Gathering cards. The Illinois Department of Corrections says the prison identified them as a security risk because of their value for trading. But in 2021, the prison began hosting Magic the Gathering tournaments using old cards that had been grandfathered in. Those in custody began to ask about buying new cards. Last year, the prison decided that staff could approve card purchases directly from a retailer. Department of Corrections spokesperson Naomi Pizzello said by email that the cards haven't caused any negative incidents. She says those in prison aren't allowed to have protective sleeves for the cards, so they get worn down and aren't as valuable as trading items. She says the game has become a constructive mental outlet for those in custody at Danville. She says it also helps reduce stress and supports emotional regulation. Psychiatrist Terry A. Coopers agrees. He's a professor at the Wright Institute in Berkeley, California. He says prisons take things away from the incarcerated too often.
Having possessions is a very important part of feeling like a human being. We're proud of the clothes we wear. We read books. We communicate with loved ones outside of correctional facilities.
The closer to normal life prisons can keep conditions, the more ready the incarcerated are to go straight afterwards. He says prisons should try to provide access to everyday items as much as possible.
It's the having access, having some freedom.
Cooper says it sounds like the men in Danville have found a creative recreational outlet that they want to do, and that's really healthy. At Danville Correctional Center, Magic the Gathering is also honing mentorship skills. Robert Schultz teaches about conflict resolution in the peer education classes and also while playing the game.
So there was a young kid and he showed up and he was watching, you know what I mean? Like kind of hovering around the table as we're all playing and he's just watching and watching and we're like, hey, do you want to play?
Then as the game heated up, Schultz says that player started to become rude.
And we had a conversation with him. I was like, hey, look, like if you're going to be hanging out with us, this is the kind of behavior that we expect.
Schultz saw the younger player learn from the conversation and start thinking about how to set boundaries in other interactions. One day, the player complained that his peers were making fun of him for playing Magic.
I explained to him, like, hey, you're sitting down here with someone, two people who are bachelor's degrees. I'm a master's degree student, right? All peer educators, all life coaches, like, what are they doing with their lives, right? Of course they're going to make fun of you.
Schultz said even having that conversation showed that the younger player felt comfortable being vulnerable with him, and that was its own win.
And if he could do it with us, imagine what he's going to do when he gets home with his family and people he, like, trusts on a more deeper level.
For Antonio Jones, Magic is a source of joy in a tough environment. He is always aware that he cannot have a bad day in prison as a mentor and as he works to show how he has grown since his conviction.
I can be overwhelmed and I can have moments of humanity where I may do something regrettable. And so I try to maintain a level of awareness to myself to be able to manage the stressors that I face on a daily basis.
So he manages the stress with music, journaling, and Magic the Gathering. I'm Emily Hayes with IPM News.
The American heartland has seen a big boon in the number of wineries over the last 3 decades, but U.S. wine sales have trended down since 2019. As part of our Food Roots series, Harvest Public Media's Rachel Kramer reports on what that means for grape growers and winemakers across the region.
In northern Iowa, the morning sun lights up a vineyard surrounded by cornfields. The grape harvest began half an hour ago with a machine pulled by a small tractor. It combs the trellises, shaking grapes off the vine. A conveyor belt pulls them into a bin. Ann Zwink is an award-winning winemaker at Soldier Creek Winery.
We're actually harvesting 4 varieties today because everything became ripe all at once last week in the heat.
One of those grape varieties is La Crescent. She says its cold hardiness and disease resistance makes it a staple for wine in Iowa and other parts of the Midwest.
It produces a really delicious orange muscat type of aroma. So like orange blossom, tea, honey, citrus.
Zwink says the harvest this year is lower than average. The vines are still recovering from a 4-year drought. Herbicides also drifted in from nearby fields, damaging a few acres. But she says the biggest challenge for her family's winery and others around the state are sales.
We have a really hard cash flow problem right now, where we have a lot of money in the tanks, and it's hard to actually sell the product that's in the tank.
And they're not the only ones with this issue.
Globally in the U.S., you know, wine sales are on the decline.
That's Randall Voss, a fruit crop field specialist with Iowa State University Extension. He says part of it has to do with more competition from hard seltzers and canned cocktails. But the number of American adults who say they drink alcohol has also dropped to 54%, according to a recent Gallup poll. That's the lowest on record in nearly 90 years.
Right now, we have a greater supply of grapes than demand. And so it's a challenge in that, what do you do, right? Do you ride it out and hopefully in a couple of years it'll be better? Or do you pull out that vineyard and that's a long-term decision?
Texas recently emerged as one of the top wine producers in the U.S., but the state is also seeing a dip in sales. Michael Cook is a viticulturalist with Texas A&M Extension.
Yes, things are slowing down right now. But there's hope that, you know, this slump will bounce back very quickly.
Cook says Texas grape growers and winemakers are faring better than the large production-focused operations in California and Washington. Tourism underscores the success of Texas wineries.
The Hill Country is kind of what most people think about when they think about Texas wine. A lot of it is because it's so close to Austin and San Antonio, and there's tons of tourism associated with the wine industry there.
This includes live music, food, and festivals. Southern Illinois is another area that draws in people from around the region. Ryan Phelps is a winemaker and grape grower at Cladding Cordon.
There's a lot of hiking in the area, a lot of outdoor activities, a lot of lakes for fishing. So we have that extra tourism bringing people here.
Along with tourists from St. Louis and Chicago, Phelps says many come from cities in Tennessee. That state is one of the few that's seen a significant increase in per capita wine consumption. Phelps sees more opportunity for growth.
I mean, I think in our area, people are probably even putting in more vines. I know we are personally.
Back at Soldier Creek Winery, Ann Zwink and her family sanitize equipment to crush and ferment several tons of grapes from their Iowa vineyard. She says the winery hosts live music and other events to draw people in. But northern Iowa is largely farmland. It's not a major tourist destination.
We're finding that we have to constantly be creating something new in order to keep interest there and to follow the trends of what consumers want.
They're producing hard cider and experimenting with new grapes. Even if those efforts are successful for just a year, Zwink says it's worth it. I'm Rachel Kramer, Harvest Public Media.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being along with us. Don't forget to join us next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app, and at nprillinois.org. Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.